Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Paradise resident Craig Heath had a long career in software as a trainer, tech writer, business and systems analyst, and product manager. So although he has made a living by writing, it was not a creative path, and he's now returned to his first love and begun a second career in fiction, poetry, and drama. In midsummer of 2016, Craig Heath threw out everything he had written over the previous 40 years, except for poems that were a memoir of his former life in verse. He declared everything else garbage and viewed it as an anchor holding him back. This collection of poems was the end of an ordinary life. He so enjoyed watching and performing the loud, ribald, jubilant form of theater called Commedia dell'arte that he wrote a short play in that style, The Shaming of the Rake. Craig Heath, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, The Shaming of the Rake sounds suspiciously like The Taming of the Shrew.
Oh, and as I believe it said, that good artists copy and great artists steal, so I stole from what I thought was the best.
Well, not everybody would even be familiar with Commedia dell'arte. How did you learn about this particular style of theater?
That was in the early part of 1981 when I was taking an introduction to theater class at Butte College. And the instructor played us a recording of The Taming of the Shrew as it was done by the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. That was in 1976. And I was just absolutely starstruck because it was done in the Commedia style, you know, the very broad acting, the acrobatic movements, the, you know, slapstick style approach. And it was done by a very young Mark Singer as Petruchio. I forget the lady's name. But it was just amazing. It just set me on fire. And so I was turned on not only to theater, but also to Commedia.
I remember a similar, now that you're describing that experience, when I watched a performance of a musical, and I can't now, it's not Rent, but... Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, boy, if it's this much fun out here in the audience, it must really be fun up there on stage.
That's exactly
so
what I
remember that moment of being bitten by the acting bug. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it was even acting. It was just having fun up there on stage.
That's what it does. And one of the things that happened very soon after seeing that just absolutely cemented it for me was that same instructor mounted a production of what's called The Marvelous Adventures of Till. And it's sort of a newer telling of an old tale of a trickster. Till Eulenspiegel was the original in Europe.
You might spell Till.
Yeah, T-Y-L or T-I-L-L. Both spellings were used throughout. And basically what we did then was we created a production that was done in kind of the Commedia style, very broad, simple staging, I mean almost no staging, and we toured it around to grade schools in the region all the way, you know, Forest Ranch on the all the way down. And what we would do is we would set up a few props, lay down a rope that defined the edge of the stage. The children would come running out. They'd all sit down in front of the rope. And then we'd pull up the rope. And now there was no division between us, the actors, and then the audience. We were all one. And, of course, we took the action in among the children. It was just – it was amazing. It was magical, nothing less than.
Well, describe then you would start saying your lines and – what were the children doing out there?
Well, at first, they would be, you know, talking amongst themselves, and they would be very involved and whatnot, and they would be pointing and laughing and whatnot. And the very first lines...
Because you're in costume, I assume.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're all in
full
all sorts,
costume.
And we change various costumes at various points. And the play begins with Till being born. And the way we accomplished that was we had one of our ladies lay on a little cot that we put together, and I hid behind her. Now, I'm 6'4". I hid behind her, and there were doctors who were very interested in what was going on, mumble, 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 this and that and the other thing, and the children were still kind of talking about themselves. And what I did was I stood up, and I bawled. I just screamed like a newborn baby. Now, here's a 6-foot man who's suddenly screaming like that. Well, I had every eye and every ear from that point on. And because of how quick the action occurred, how much we interacted, and it was overblown, you know, in the extreme. Loud lines and big action and lots of movement and such like that. We had them from that moment on. And eventually, like I said, we went running into the audience. There's a chase scene where Till has now won the love of the young lady whose father is trying to lock her up and keep her dowry. And so we run through the children. We'd hide behind them. And the old man would come around and say, "Where are they? Where are they?" And they'd say, "Oh, he's over there. He's over there." And he'd run off and everything, and they would just squeal with delight. It was just amazing. So that was it. As you say, bitten
they
by
became
the,
a part of the play.
They were part of the play. And that is what I think really happens, even if you're sitting in a theater and watching a play. If it's done right and if you're engaged fully, you're in it. It was just that this was more, you know, obvious and involved the fact that we were right there among them.
There's a sentence in your book that I particularly liked, and you said, "A troop of crazy college kids invaded their school and gave them a peek at how the sheer joy being human can be expressed with body, voice, and words." The sheer joy being human. And I think, what have we done to our school children these days? I don't think we show them the sheer joy of being human.
And something like this is relatively simple. It's not hard to do. It's not rocket science. So I'm not sure why these kinds of things are not happening. But again, it wasn't just for them. You can imagine what it did for us, not only as aspiring actors, but as young people, you know, in our teens and 20s and whatnot, to engage with younger children like that to the point to where we knew that they would jump into our arms if we allowed it. And what it gave us in terms of the experience of what theater could do or any sort of very expressive art. I think I also mentioned that Commedia being so big and broad is like expressive drumming or, you know, any kind of really, really engaging art that is, you know, felt as well as heard and thought.
My guest is Craig Heath, and he has written a short but delightful Commedia dell'arte play, The Shaming of the Rake. And so you've just described how you and your troupe would go around to schools and get the kids excited about the joy of being human. But, you know, Craig, if I'm a teacher, I want students to sit there and be quiet and follow instructions. And so what happened after you would leave?
That was, in a way, part of the most satisfying part of it, perhaps, but not in a good way. Our instructor began getting calls and letters from principals and vice principals and teachers complaining that the children that we had left behind did not very much resemble the ones that had been there just the day before. They were, in many ways, you could say they were out of control. Not completely, obviously. But certainly not following the rules as they had been laid down before, even to the
point. So you were a troublemaker.
We were very much troublemakers, which
you say with pride.
I do, in a way, because the story of Till is one of individuality. The way they expressed it in the play is that he gets fitted for glasses young, when he's very young. The glasses represent conformity. Whenever he's wearing the glasses, he's a good boy, and he does things the way they're supposed to be done. Well, then the glasses fall off, and suddenly he's himself. And he's himself in a way that he leads everyone around him into a state of freedom. He's in school. The glasses fall off. He leads the students in a state of freedom away from the teacher who was teaching them wrong. The play calls for the teacher to point to blue and say it's red. And that, think of that, all those children in the audience were screaming, "No, it's blue," you know. So he was not giving them good instruction. Till leads them away from that, and the next thing you know, they're dancing and laughing and everything. And so it was a story about being who you are and being someone who, again, is joyous to be human and to be free.
Well, when I think of a trickster, and you mentioned that this is in cultures all over the world, and I think of the African fable that came to the United States and is recounted as Brer Rabbit.
Oh, yes.
And Brer Rabbit was a trickster. Mm-hmm. But I mean, listening to your description of Till was a different kind of trickster.
I mean,
still survived by their wits, but Till seems like a very appealing character.
A trickster can be appealing or not appealing, and his was, or the character of Till in this telling is. Because again, he has absolutely no malice in his heart. He has no desire. You know, the fact that he leads the children to be free from this sort of conformity is not in any way malicious. It's saying you don't have to follow, you know, anybody else's path. You can be yourself. And like I say, not a malicious bone in his body is nothing, and no greed. He doesn't steal, you know, he doesn't steal away with the girl because he wants her dowry. He does it because he loves the girl. And so that's what, to me, gave this air of legitimacy to the character that I felt completely at ease with portraying and instilling in the children, even if that led them to maybe get a little trouble in the playground.
Well, we've talked around this Commedia dell'arte. Can you give us a more concise idea of what Commedia dell'arte is?
Actually, and I'm glad you bring that up, because technically the fact that this is a written play means it's really not Commedia dell'arte, because Commedia dell'arte was all about improvisation. A troupe of actors, this is Renaissance era throughout, you know, I mean, it's even going on today. A troupe of actors would, each one would take on and deeply learn and embody a particular character that was an archetype. So you would have, you know, the young trickster, for example, is one of them. That would be Harlequino in a lot of the traditions. The brave captain who the big braggart who is actually, you know, a coward. The miser, you know, the money bags, etc., like that. And they would use very expressive masks to also, and costuming, to really embody these characters. But when they would then set up their stage in a new town, they had general lines of stories that they would work with, but they would completely do improvisations of that particular play. And sometimes they'd incorporate things they had heard about from that town, you know, whatever. Maybe they would start to sound like one of the local magistrates or, you know, something like that. So it's almost completely improvisational. So the fact that this is an actual play with, you know, specific lines, you know, I'm taking
stretching
a few liberties.
A
yeah, just a little bit.
Well, in your script, you give us an idea of, before we even read who the person is, the very name of the character tells us about that person. And I didn't even have to look at your English translation. Lord Avery, you might guess, Lord Greedy, Lord Digitos, uses his digits, his fingers. Lady Fidelis is a faithful lady. And you go through Flores, of course, flowers. And so as we're reading the script, we don't have to flip back and say, now, who is this character? Because the very name gives us a clue. Oh, here's who that is.
Yeah, it's with that I give the best nod to Commedia, in the sense that each one is an archetype. And then the archetype is given through a humor name. Now, I could have stuck with the English names, I guess, but I just wanted that extra little bit of something that said that, you know, wait a minute, you know, that sounded just a little bit more like it fit the time period, or the fake time period that I was trying to portray.
Well, since you are an actor, and you know what fun you had writing these lines, I know you must have even more fun, if not equally so, reading these lines.
Absolutely.
So why don't you set up this first scene, and then if you will be so gracious as to permit me, I will read along with you, because I just find it all so delightful. I can't help but join in with you. So what happens up until Mistress Colina speaks?
Okay. So what we get at the very beginning is we learn what Lord Digitos is all about and what his friend Avari is, and that is that Digitos is a skirt chaser. Avari is basically a greedy miser, and Avari has gotten himself in trouble with a big debt that he owes. Digitos can give him the money to pay the debt, but in payment, what Digitos wants is Avari's permission to chase about with one of his kitchen ladies and such. And in the meanwhile, Lady Fidelis, Digitos' wife, has seen this transpire. But she's also long-suffering. She knows her husband, and she knows what's going on.
Because her very name says she's faithful.
She is.
Yes.
She is indeed.
In spite of the husband's.
And so when the two men leave, Fidelis is left in the kitchen with Mr. Scalina, who's the cook and head of the household, and then the two serving maids or kitchen wenches, however you'd like to put it, Flores and Fructus. And so Mr. Scalina is now going to try to apologize and try to mollify the Lady Fidelis and talk about it in such a way. We get to the point where we set ourselves up for how they're going to plan to, you know, shame the gentleman. So how would you like to split this up?
Well, since we're going to have to play both genders, why don't you read Mistress Kulina, mm-hmm. and I'll read Flores, and we'll just alternate, and I'll, if I may, read Lady Fidelis.
Oh, please do.
Yes.
And I'll do Fructus, and what I'll do is I'll just call out the name of each character as
okay.
we go. So, Mistress Kulina says, "Oh, my good, sweet Lady Fidelis, how I wish you had not witnessed that which just transpired here. To see such things is to partake of a bitter dish without so much as the sweet wine of his regard to cleanse the palate. And, good lady, do please hear me when I swear to Venus none of us have marred our virtue by inviting his intentions."
"No," this is Flores speaking,
Flores.
A kitchen. "I swear as well by God that all I hold dear."
Fructus, "And I so too, my swearing and my deeds shall show."
Lady Fidelis, "Good ladies of the kitchen, pray you hear me now. If womanhood be like a tree, then we are boughs."
And then the three ladies together all go, "Ah, oh."
"Ah, oh."
Lady Fidelis
continues, "I hold you not one of you, to any blame for that which my true mate may do by his free will." Her mate being Lord Digitos,
mm-hmm.
I might add.
That's right.
"His actions be his own, and though some pinch of shame might reach beneath my ribs to take up residence in my fair heart, I must remember and fulfill the promise I did swear to him without pretense. Love, honor, and obey I vowed to him by God, and as long as I and he do breathe, then my good will is his by right, until the day our bones are sod."
And all the ladies,
And the Lady Fidelis continues, "That being said, my duty begs more than assent. My hand and heart can help him be a better gent."
Then Flores.
"Now here's a lady will protest, but not too much."
Fructus says, "Methinks she'll keep her word and his good scruples touch." And Mistress Kulina says, "If I may venture bold, good lady, do you mean to undertake instruction of your man tonight? Mayhaps you might contrive to orchestrate a scene in which he may be forced to play the bitter fool and so be shamed from that behavior that doth smite your faithful heart?"
Lady Fidelis says, "I do, Kulina, think to school my errant husband such that he might know the pain a woman's pride endures with every thoughtless slight a lover might inflict, that tears her faith in twain."
And the two women go,
And
Mistress Kulina says, "If that be so, good lady, I would a thought impart. Let us stroll and talk of vengeance as an art."
And the two of us, we walk
leave.
At the exit.
That's
yes.
right.
So that's part of that scene. Any comments you want to make about that?
Well, what I was, it's fairly obvious, but the key thing that I think would be interesting for a director here is Lady Fidelis truly faithful, or is this a big show? You know, she makes this big show of how I must remain faithful to him no matter what he does, or would he play her a little bit more cynical? The way I wrote it when I had it in my head, it's honest and faithful and true, but you could go either way with it. And that's another thing that I've always loved about theater. if the playwright does not inject too much direction, and unless they want to, they of course can, but if they don't, then each director and each production and each new actor can actually bring something new to that portrayal, and that way it's always fresh.
So Lady Fidelis could have her tongue in her cheek when she's talking.
She very well could.
My guest is Craig Heath, and we're reading from The Taming of the Rake, being a short but most delightful Commedia dell'arte play. And, of course, the rake is Lord Digitos.
Indeed. Lord Fingers.
Yes, Lord Fingers. Well, why don't we read then after Gladio and Protagat? Protagat, it seems like since the protect.
I went with Protagat,
okay.
Just basically,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, shall we read that? I'll read Flores again.
Okay. So just to set up here, now what has happened is now that the other ladies have left, the two kitchen maids are alone and we have a little transition, but then each of them is in love with one of the guards. And Gladio is in love with Flores, and Protagat is in love with Fructas. And so they come in, and they're going to be trying to, you know, win their ladies' hearts, which they have been trying to do for nigh on a year. And we'll go with that. So if I do Gladio and Protagat, you
okay.
Do, okay. So Gladio enters and says, Flores, dear, my perfect rose, come and see the gift I bring to happily greet my dearest love, this blossom, fair and sweet, that makes me think of thee and pine for but a touch of your soft hand.
Oh, dear. This is Flores now. Mm-hmm. He's been speaking to brave Gladio. You have my heart and all thereof. It is mine to give. But we have spoke for nigh a year of that which would make right with law and also God our passion true. So till that blessed day, a glove must keep our hands apart, lest I be thought a bawd. Hast thou procured the needful that will pave the way so our matrimonial vows can finally say?
You know, or have you put together a stake that we can get started with?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, da, 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 da. Yeah. So Protagat says an aside, and this is another thing that I love about this style, is asides to the audience, really mm-hmm. wink and a nod out to the audience. And so Protagat
to bring them in on the fun. Yeah,
exactly. So Protagat says, I see 'tis time I keep my sacred soldier's creed and rush to save a comrade in his hour of need. So then he turns to his beloved Fructus and says, Fructus, dear, my perfect palm, come take from me an offering that I do pray you will enjoy. This apple, crisp and sweet, that makes me think of thee and yearn for but a brush of your soft lips.
And then Fructus says, oh, dear, stout Protagat, I would with kiss express my joy at seeing you. But as you know, a barren year has passed since we in a secret pact gave troth to endless love. So if thou canst the vicar employ this day, our passion must again put on sackcloth. Hast thou yet set aside a modicum of coin to ready for the day our hearts and souls conjoin?
And so we have the two guards now looking at each other. I don't know
what to do.
She's
talking money there.
Exactly. And so then, you know, as it moves, the scene moves on now, the manservant to Avari, Master Malum, comes in and pays them two coins each for all their work, and then takes one back for bed and board. And then they have to give their only coins to the ladies later on.
My guest is Craig Heath. We're reading from The Shaming of the Rake, which is a play that he wrote in the Commedia dell'arte style. And Shakespeare is your inspiration, and Shakespeare wrote in a particular rhyme scheme. And I don't think I'm doing it justice as I read it, because I'm reading it in rather the conversational style. Mm-hmm. So how did you work on the rhyme scheme for this?
And actually, the conversational style is exactly what you want to accomplish. You don't want it to sound like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. What I did was, when I was in college, I wrote a play as part of a final for poetry. And he said, try and devise a new style or a style. You know, do something really strict. So I came up with a rhyme scheme and a structure that used iambic pentameter, and then also had a rhyme scheme I thought was new but wasn't. In any case, so when it came around to do this, I just used that. And what it is now is in hexameter per line. And then each stanza is 9 lines with a rhyming scheme that's kind of internal. And then I'd use couplets often as a kind of punctuation.
Well, when you were writing about this in your book, I pulled off I know it's a very old book of mine called Fundamentals of Poetry, and I know it's old because it's written, my maiden name is the name that's on it. So I was looking at tetrameter, pentameter, hexameter, and I was also looking at something that you thought you invented, and lo and behold, here it was described in this little book on the Fundamentals of Poetry. You're nodding because you know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Exactly, the nocturne. Yeah, I thought I had just, you know, reached into the heavens and pulled something new out and that the gods didn't even know about. But of course, you know, I was about 22 years old or 23 years old and quite full of myself. So, you know, teacher said, no, good try, good work, but not new.
You didn't invent it.
I didn't invent
it. Yes. And here's a terza rima, a 3-line stanza. And so you, though, were enjoying writing in this style many years ago, before you got around to getting back to this.
Very much so. Like I said, when I did that poem for a final, that was in 1982, I believe, and when I was at Butte. And I was absolutely full of the idea that my life from this point on was going to go in this direction. And I couldn't tear myself away from one or the other. I was very deeply involved in theater in the area, and then I was writing like crazy, and I was just sure, absolutely sure, that what I was going to do basically was follow, among other things, the Hemingway model, because I also became a reporter and a journalist for first the Butte College paper and then local papers and whatnot. I was going to be a journalist for a while, and meanwhile, I was going to work on that novel, you know, and I was going to come out eventually with the Great American Novel, and then that was going to be my life for the rest of my life. And well, you know, things turned out a little different.
Well, you then you had been writing many years ago, and you come to a point where you're going to toss out everything, and then you have a new book also, The End of an Ordinary Life, and this is what you saved. Apparently, you threw out everything else. And you save these poems that kind of serve as a memoir. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk to you about this when we come back from a break, about your collection of poems that you call The End of an Ordinary Life, and ask you about that title, Craig.
I'd love to.
The End of an Ordinary Life. But also, I'd like to do another scene in your play, The Shaming of the Rake, which is a Commedia dell'arte play. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Craig Heath, and he had a long career as a software trainer, tech writer, business and systems analyst, and product manager. And even though he made a living at writing, it was not a creative kind of writing. And so he's returned to his first love and begun a second career in fiction, poetry, and drama. And so we have been enjoying this drama that he has written, and he says it's not exactly right to have written it down, but at least we can have fun with it in its written form. Mm-hmm. So, Craig, can you set up a scene then? We've been reading from some of the characters in your book, and what about on page 22, or actually 21, mm-hmm. where Lord Digitos is saying, oh, house do so well. I enjoy a secret tryst. So you might remind people who Lord Digitos is.
Right. Lord Digitos is he's the rake. Basically, he's a married man, but he's a skirt chaser. His wife is long suffering of this quirk, if you will, in his character. And the base of the play is that she's going to take this opportunity to perhaps shame him, to scare him, to change him, to make him be a better man. And so up to this point in the story, his friend Avari has set it up so that he can meet with one of the kitchen ladies. They're out in the garden of Avari's estate. And so Avari has said, okay, you know, he's received his money that he's going to use to pay his debtors. And he leaves, and we leave Digitos alone in the garden for a moment, and we get a little soliloquy from him that, okay, now you're really going to understand what Digitos is all about. Now, who he's meeting is Master Malum, disguised as a kitchen wench, who is going to give him, Digitos, a taste of his own medicine.
This is all also pretty typical of that period of
exactly. You know, the whole disguise,
and he won't recognize. They never recognize the person in disguise.
Of course, the disguise was perfect.
It was total.
Absolutely. So
okay.
Avari leaves and Digitos says, aside again to the audience, "Oh, how I do so well enjoy a secret tryst. 'Tis like a sport, invigorating to the mind and body both. And when a pretty lass is kissed, does she not too feel the flush of quickened life that is the blessing God gave man and womankind? Indeed she does. And yet, the pledge I gave my wife so long ago remains intact. My wedding vow forbids me wish or have another one in kind as she. And I have kept my word from then till now. None can compare to her. She is my very heart. But now and then a man succumbs to Cupid's dart."
So then Master Malum enters, disguised as a kitchen wench. "My lord."
Now, what we want to briefly mention here is that in the Commedia style now, Malum, as the woman, is going to be treating him the way he treats other women, which is to basically grab them. And we would do things like with a bulb horn honk, and there would be shrieking. So when you come in and say, "My lord," you grab me, and I go, "Ah." And I say, what? "Who art thou? What doth deign to touch my person in so intimate a manner? Speak."
"Oh, this is Master Malum. Forgive me, lord, if I do seek to clutch thy beauteous and manly frame. For I am but a poor and guiltless girl, most innocent and weak, who doth but wish to give myself to you for what might please you best."
"You do?"
Master Malum. "I do, my lord, in truth."
"I thank thee, but I hesitate, for you do speak unlike a poor and guiltless girl."
"I swear, in sooth."
Yeah, in the line.
"I am, as you can plainly see, one who would thrill if you, my lord, would all my girlish dreams fulfill."
And then again with the grab and the ah, and we're on the threes. We do everything in threes, you know, for comedy's sake. "I cannot say. I thought myself a connoisseur of female beauty, but I must confess my lack. That which makes thee womanly doth fail to stir affection's edge in me, the more I ask your pardon." And he tries to leave.
And then Master Malum replies, "Oh, good sir, I beg thee, do not bid me pack so soon." And so I grab you and keep you from leaving. "Let us tarry in this lovely garden but a while, and I will quickly prove to you my weakness is but invitation for attack."
"How anyone could call you weak, I can't construe. You seem familiar to me, though I do forget. Did Master Malum your ancestors also beget?"
We are cousins, sir, and you he doth esteem full well. But I your manly virtues deem supreme."
Yeah.
And then I grab you again.
Again. "I thank thee for thy kind regard, and do regret that I must give you over at this our first brief encounter. But I have enjoyed our short duet, and so farewell."
And then, "But good, my lord, I beg thee, stay."
And so and now here is where, of course, it all comes together, because now his wife shows up, and here he is,
caught red-handed.
Yeah, caught red-handed. But she has something going on of her own, which is that she and the two guards are going to pretend that they are vying for her hand, and he's going to be able to witness that go on. And that's the whole trick then of it, is that she knows what he's doing. He doesn't know that what she's up to, and she's going to give him a taste of his own medicine.
Well, this is so much fun to read, but it's so new that have you actually, I suppose it has not been produced.
It has not. might never, but what did happen was I was asked by the lady, Jerry Leavers, who currently portrays Mary Queen of Scots in the reenactment group that my wife and I are part of.
I don't think we mentioned that.
No, we didn't. And that's kind of where it started, is that she said, so what we do is we portray the court of Mary Queen of Scots in 1562. And we do this at Celtic fairs and Scottish games and things like that. And so we're always looking for something to give to the patrons, something new that we can do. We call them gigs, and they're you know, small performances and whatnot. And she asked me, could you write a short play that we could perform? We could pretend that we were performing it for Her Majesty, and then patrons could watch it. And so, of course, I took off with it. And so with the result of it, when I started in 2015, throughout 2016, I would bring versions of it to the next fair where we all gathered, and we would read through it and we'd practice it a little bit. But finally, last year, every year around Christmas time, we have a big party for ourselves just for fun. We call it Winter Feast. And so we did a reading performance of it there, you know, top to bottom with, you know, everybody cast in characters and whatnot. So it's had a, you know, a performing read-through, I guess is what you could call it. And that's all so far.
So you have, in a way, produced some of the ideas behind this. And you mentioned you're in costume, mm-hmm. and this group, the reenactors, with Mary, Queen of Scots. And I might, since listeners can't see you, ask you to describe what you're wearing today. Because first of all, you could pass easily for a Scotsman, even if you weren't in costume. You look very Scottish, I might say. And you're even wearing... What are you wearing today?
I'm wearing a kilt.
I'm wearing a kilt.
What I call a practical kilt. You may have said the main company that's known for them is called Utilikilt, but there's many, many manufacturers of it. And basically, it's a kilt with pockets. And as soon as, for example, my wife and I were able to go to Scotland last year, and I wore them because I wear almost nothing else now. It's just the most comfortable piece of clothing I've ever had in my life, so I thought, why not
wear this? Is your normal attire?
Yes, this is what I would normally wear. And we were in Scotland, and I was wearing my kilt, and it's not popular over there. Scotsmen only wear kilts for formal occasions like weddings or if you're a performer or, you know, a tour guide or something like that. So I'm walking around in this odd kilt, and they would ask me, you know, what's that you're wearing? And I said, well, this is what happens when a Yank wants to wear a kilt. He puts pockets on it and calls it good. So there, I have a lot of these, and I have some regular tartan kilts as well.
Yeah, because these are black that you're wearing.
Yeah, this one is black duck cloth, and like I said, with cargo pockets on the side and side pockets and whatnot. And so that's why I call it a practical kilt, is I don't have to wear a sporran and everything else. So anyway, because I started wearing a kilt all the time, precisely because I had started wearing it for the reenactment group, St. Andrew's Guild, and I realized, this is so comfortable, why am I not wearing them all the time? So that's what I wear all the time now, and that's what I've done for some time now.
And where, if I call it the headquarters of this reenactment group?
We're basically centered in Central California. We're spread, like we live up in Paradise. The farthest south we have are folks down in, say, Burlingame, that area, as far east as Pioneer and as far west as San Francisco. So we have a headquarters of sorts in Escalon. That's where our guild master, Jeff Levers, lives, and he has all our props, and you know we go there to load stuff up and take it to the next fair. And we have fairs from as far north as Grass Valley. There's the KNVR Celtic Music Fair there in mm-hmm. October, down as far down as Monterey. That's coming up this next month. And so we go around, you know, about that area, doing about half a dozen, six, seven, eight events a year. And we also go out to schools. Middle school will often have a Renaissance unit. And when they do, so we have several that we contract with where we go out and we, you know, give presentations with, you know, in full garb and, you know, show them a weapons demonstration and court manners and things like that. It's really wonderful. It kind of harkens back to what we were talking about with regard to when I was back in college and I was doing the play for those children.
My guest is Craig Heath, and he has written a short but most delightful Commedia dell'arte play that he calls The Shaming of the Rake. And the title character is named Lord Digitos. And we've been reading scenes with Lord Digitos and his wife, Lady Fidelis. And so I'd like to read one more, a scene in your play, Craig. This is on page 31. And he and his wife are talking. Anything else you need to set up before we start reading that scene?
Yeah, real briefly. So from where we left off, Fidelis has come in and Digitos and Malum, as the kitchen wench, are hiding, you know, behind a bush or something. Doesn't matter. You could hold your hand up and say, I'm hiding behind a bush.
And nobody would see you.
And nobody would see you. And so she and the two guardsmen have gone through this very elaborate play of their own where they have fought each other for her hand to the point to where they have died. And the two girls, Floris and Fructus, have come out wailing and screaming, oh my goodness, why would they do this? And so Lord Avari, who is their uncle, comes out. He's completely fooled by this. So he's absolutely broken that the men have died. And so they have accused Lady Fidelis of witchcraft, that she bewitched the men to fight over here and to kill her, to kill themselves. And so they're about to grab her and basically, you know, burn her as a witch. So that is where the point where it's too much for Digitos, and he has to reveal himself, and he does so with a soliloquy, and then he's answered by his wife.
Okay, so you're reading Lord Digitos, and I will read Lady Fidelis.
Okay, so they're about to grab her, and he suddenly jumps up and he says, "Hold! Have all of you been robbed of any sense? My lady is not, as you say, a cursed witch with power that could make a man insane and thence to murder his own blood. She is a woman, more sinned against than sinning. And all your rage you must now switch from her to me, for I am he this evil wind engendered. Yea, my inattention and most shameless acts I see now are the cause of that for which I must now take full blame, and she you must hold blameless. She sought out love from they who might today provide that which I once promised to an honest bride."
"Good my lord, how glad it makes my heart to hear your words, and see sincerity in your clear eyes. The man you are, you've always been, and you endear yourself to me with all your faults. I would not change my place with Aphrodite, for your love I prize above all else. But, yea, you have of late been strange to me and to my open heart. 'Tis true I sought solace, separate from your arms. My quiet cries you did not hear. My heart was with great sadness wrought. I do not seek excuse for that which I have done, but understanding ask so that we be not undone."
"The fault be mine entire, good my lady wife."
"Perhaps. But let us now leave off all talk of strife."
And they embrace.
And live happily ever after, shall we assume?
Well.
Till the next time.
In fact, there's a little, you know, gag at the end where, you know, he says, you know, "Kiss me, Kate," just as a
yes.
joke. And she says, "Who is Kate?" and slaps him. So, you know.
Yes, you pull in that line.
In fact, there are a few little Easter eggs in it. I literally took a few teeny tiny lines out of a few different Shakespeare plays, especially Taming of the Shrew, and just kind of stuck them in there hither and yon.
Well, particularly since Kiss Me, Kate was the name of a movie,
right.
I'm thinking people will get that reference that one, he brings
yeah.
in.
Right.
First, Kiss Me, Kate, and says, "Who is Kate?"
And then it's smack.
There's a wench. He seems to rather enjoy the fact that she
Indeed.
Well, you have told us how you came to write in the style of Commedia dell'arte and the rhyme and the language, which you pull in. And you also caution that this is put down on paper, so it's not authentic in that sense.
That's true.
But I'm sure when you and your reenactors do some of this, they are free not to have to memorize the lines as they are, but just to know who their archetype are.
And in interestingly, the group, because I wrote it at the request of the queen,
the lady playing Mary Queen of Scots.
Indeed, our group has what we call houses that have all of these elements in it. So we have a noble house, we have noble men and women. We have a guard house of – we actually have guards. We have what we call the Highlander house, which is the serving people and whatnot. So I had everything I needed right there. So I have four noble people, three from the Highlanders or the servings, and, you know, two of the guards, and boom, that's it. It's cast. And when we did the reading performance of it last December, we cast people – who were in those exact costumes and in those exact roles. And so, boom, it was done. Even costuming, too.
Well, I want to offer my apologies, too, because I would forget sometimes that I was supposed to be a scullery maid, so to speak.
Oh.
And so my language level was probably not appropriate for a maid. But,
not a worry. Not a worry at all.
But I know you'll have fun with this down the road. Now, I would like to go to your collection of poems. And you called it The End of an Ordinary Life. Why did you call it that? Because it's not the end of your life. You do say an ordinary life.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you call this collection of poems by that title?
Well, a few different things. One of them was I had a moment of thinking about writing my father's memoir. And it was an ordinary life. Just as mine is, really. And what I realized was what can appear from the outside as an ordinary life can be, and my contention always is, rich internally. And So he had his own internal rich life, but I didn't know it. I didn't know his life well enough, you know, inside of him. I never got very close to him. So I said to myself, well, sure, I could probably write about the things that I know of that he did, but it wouldn't have the impact that a true memoir would. So I shelved that idea.
Well, in your book, you describe when your dad died, and you said my father was bewildered and afraid, mm-hmm. and that he died as he had lived, and you'd hope for better. Mm-hmm. And when my own dad died, the Historical Society asked me to write, I guess you would call it a biography, and they wanted more than just the dates he graduated from college, and they wanted more of this that is inaccessible to us, mm-hmm. as children. I mean, I found it so. So I went back through scrapbook and what newspaper articles I could find, and I remember him saying that he had a little dog named Tut because he named it at the time that they had discovered King Tut in Egypt. But those kinds of little tidbits were hard to come by. And so that's why you decided, I can't write my dad's story.
Yeah, I can't. I couldn't do his story justice. So time passes, and I got to this point where I wanted to start over on the path that I had started and left behind so long ago, which was to write creatively, to write fiction, to write poetry, to write drama. And I had, as you say, I had thrown away everything that I had done in the previous 40 years, one summer, last summer.
Did you regret that? Because I just couldn't
imagine. I don't yet. Let me put it that way.
Because I was curious the way you did it, because when I start going through files and thinking, okay, I'm going to clean this out, I'm going to throw it away, and then, oh, but I'd like to keep this. So how did you overcome that?
Well, I had done exactly as you described for many, many, many years. I would go through it. I would pore over it. I would weep. You know, I would just – and that is what I describe as being an anchor that dragged me down, is that I was stuck in the idea that all of these artifacts represented a time when I wrote, and it was like a block to a time when I could write. And it felt that way more and more, year by year by year. So what I decided was that if I was going to break away from it, I had to get rid of it all. I had to get rid of it all in one big swoop. And I couldn't have the slightest temptation to, like you say, hang on to that one little thing. So boxed everything up, stacked it outside of my shop where I store everything, and I asked my son to make a dump run. And I just said, you know, it's a bunch of boxes of trash. Just throw it off the tailgate of your truck, which he did, you know, and he didn't know what it was.
Well, because he had no emotional attachment to it like you did.
No, but I had also told him it was just trash, you know. So,
yeah,
thanks. You know, I paid him a few bucks, you know, got some gas. And he made that dump run for me, which he'd done before. You know, this is like, you know, a normal
sort
of thing.
No big deal for him.
No big deal. And that way, I was not there. I wasn't present. And it was all done in one big movement. And that was it. It was gone. Now, I describe it as being, you know, irretrievable. And I guess if I really wanted to be crazy, I could have run out there that day and tried to pick something up. But I didn't. And you ask if I regret it. And so far, no, because it seems to have accomplished what I was after, because ever since then, I mean, I had been writing the play before, but ever since then, I have been writing like crazy. I'm publishing on a site called Medium. I've got all kinds of short stories and poems out there and stuff like that. And so what this book now becomes,
The End of Ordinary Life,
is all the poems that I didn't throw away because I had them in computer files, because I had been planned to try to publish them for a long time. I was going to try to put together a book of a certain structure or something like that. Years and years and years. So what I said was, these poems, in the order that I currently have them in the book, represent the best of what I not only wrote but also what I saved. And they are in an exact order from beginning to end. The order
in which
I wrote
them. Which you wrote them.
Right. Starting from about 1980. I had done some before, but about then. All the way through to about 2007. And I hadn't been writing, you know, since then. So I said, all right, here's the last thing to do to move away from that previous life, is let's publish. Let's take this, which I've always wanted to do, and put it into a published form. Now, it's self-published, but that's still published as far as I'm concerned. It accomplishes, it accomplishes what I want. It's saying, all right, here's an endpoint. Here's a period to that sentence. Now let's move on to the next.
Well, you mentioned having written these in chronological order. So I'm assuming that your poem called Magic Bullet was written in 1964?
No, not exactly. That was written in the
As a reflection.
Yeah, that was written in the mid-80s.
Oh, because, she wasn't Jackie O then. She hadn't married Onassis.
That's right.
Right.
And it was written after I saw the movie JFK. Mm-hmm. Now, I had been fascinated with the entire story since high school. For example, my mom bought an abridged copy, a popular copy of the Warren Commission report, and I read it when I was in high school. And I've been absolutely fascinated with the story ever since, including, after and when Jackie became Jackie O and mm-hmm. such like that. Well, after seeing JFK, and I have a bit of a political bent, there was something came out of that. I don't know exactly how, but what it started with was the picture of her on the jet, on the airplane.
Iconic.
Yeah. Standing there. Her husband had been killed in her arms just a few hours before, and how she held it together. And I was thinking, what could possibly be going on in her mind, in her heart at that moment? And she could still stand there. So it started with that. And then it sort of morphed into, then I pictured her sort of on a beach when she was Jackie Onassis many years later. But that moment and all the moments that led up to it would still be there, very much on the surface.
So I don't want to spoil it for the reader, but I was reading along too. She's stretched on this beach. She was married to this wealthy man who had a yacht. And then all of a sudden, the scene changes.
Mm-hmm.
So would you read A Magic Bullet for us, Craig?
Oh, Jackie, Jackie O, I see you stretched out on Mediterranean sands, tanning your still lean body, eyes closed behind dark glasses and hat brim on this any one of 1,000 days. The yacht will return in a week, Ari said, to carry you home. Home. Meanwhile, waves lap your ankles like loyal pups, steadily, predictably, rhythmically lulling you into pleasant dreams. Somewhere in the vaults, among national treasures, in a windowless, airtight room, a piece of truth lies hidden, folded carefully into archival covers. The dress, the pink dress suit that Jack called smashing, is stained and spattered with the indelible marks of ambush. You knew he was dead. You were the first to know. He slumped into your lap, the dress soaking with blood and brains. You closed the gaping door in his skull and held him, tried to hold him together, enfolding him in those pink arms, stroking him with needlessly gentle fingers in those white, white gloves. Oh, Jackie, Jackie O, the magic bullet got Jack first, crashing through bone and muscle, turning, climbing, diving into another man, then passing through to speed on in its perfect trajectory, seeking others, following them home. Home. Meanwhile, lies ring in our ears like pealing bells, repeatedly, endlessly, maddeningly grinding hearts into comfortable fear. My God, they're going to kill us all, Connolly screamed, while the clean killer sped away. It whistles its way through time and space, seeking the next and the next. Listen, you can hear the echoes in the canyons of time. Lee, Malcolm, Martin, Robert. Never seen, rarely heard, the magic bullet sails on. It stops, waits, then turns and vanishes, rising, falling, striking another and passing through. I hear it in the distance now, closing the gap at high velocity. Oh, Jackie, Jackie O, I see you standing frozen on Air Force One, controlling your still shaking body, eyes wide behind the shock of knowledge on that last of the 1,000 days. It will be over in a week, someone said. You should go home. Home. Meanwhile, Dreams tear at your heart like hungry dogs, snarling, snapping, relentlessly chasing you into each new morning.
My guest is Craig Heath. He has been reading from his collection of poems, The End of an Ordinary Life. There is another poem that you wrote, apparently, on your first anniversary. You dedicate your book to your wife, Patricia, and this poem, A Gift of Paper, this is on page 114.
Yes. If there's anything that this book does for me, it is a way of showing myself that I finally learned one good lesson. And that one good lesson is how to let myself be loved. And Patricia, Pat, taught me that lesson.
I suspect that women are better than that, than men are, the Craig.
So as well. And so what happened was, this is the poem that I wrote her for our first anniversary, and we've had 19 since. And so what this again proves to me is that I did the right thing. I made the right choice. So this is called A Gift of Paper for Patricia on our first. We measure a marriage in years, as if the clock and calendar could meter the depth of our union. Better to count our mingled tears, our fights and copulations, or minutes spent in pillow talk before sleep commands us. I would rather yardstick our love by how I miss your scent, your laughter, when I've been away for a day or an hour. But we measure in years. Anniversaries are ticked off like hands of the clock with the circular passing of Saul, and this is our first. A year, a microsecond in the millennia, gave me 365 nightfalls beside you and mornings rising to your voice. When I was a child, a year was a lifetime, but now it speeds by. I feel as if I slept yesterday a bachelor, rose this morning as your husband. To mark the rarity of anniversaries, gifts of value are assigned. Tin, pottery, silver, gold, diamond. For this, our first most precious year, I am to give you paper. Paper, that common and least valued medium, is to mark our year of blood union. What irony. Such a beauty, a beginning, like a newborn, should be marked with so poor a gift. Yet it is with paper, poor paper, that we commit ourselves in contract, signing our names on solemn oaths. On paper, plain paper, we scratch out the plans for cities and songs, draft manifestos and philosophies for the epoch, and write poems. Paper unites us, not with its lowly quality, but with the message it conveys, the meaning scratched on its surface. Paper is only the medium carrying the song in my heart to yours. So I give you this gift of paper to carry the news to you. Someday I will give you a diamond when our years are deemed worthy of so costly a gift. But even that rare gem will be only paper, a messenger, to carry the same words to you that I scribble here. I love you. I need you. I would marry you again tomorrow or in 1,000 years. I would die for you or live for you. I would spill my blood for you with the ease that ink flows from this pen. Our love is that blood, that ink. The paper is our vow of union, and the message we write there is the song of our marriage.
My guest has been Craig Heath. He is reading from his collection of poems, The End of an Ordinary Life. We also read lines from The Shaming of the Rake, a delightful commedia dell'arte play. Craig, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.